Hello, everybody. I'm here with the fantastic Spey Jenkins. And we are going to do this podcast for the Rutgers University students. And thank you so much for doing this afternoon.
You.
I know your time is very precious, and I really, really appreciate this. But the reason I do this is because, first of all, I must confess that I use you many times as my advisor. And that is because I think great of you. I mean, you are one of the most knowledgeable people I know, not only about the business, but also about opera in general.
Thank you.
And that's why it's so important that you're doing this for the kids, which some are not so kids, I must say, especially the grad students. First of all, I wanted to ask you, because I don't know myself, how did you start with the bug of opera? I'm always curious, you know, how people is from family, from friends.
I was very early. When I was 6 years old, in those days, in the Neanderthal times, when I was born, they pushed people forward ahead in school if you could read. They didn't realize that from a physical, from an emotional standpoint, you should stay in the same grade you're supposed to be. So I was 2 years ahead of myself. And when I was six, my music teacher mentioned in class the word opera, or something about opera, and I came home and asked my parents, and my mother, I was at dinner, my mother said, well, opera is where people sing all the time, they don't talk. And I said, really? And she said, yes. And I said, well, what is it about? And she said, well, they have stories. She said, for instance, there's one story where a woman is put to sleep on a rock surrounded by fire, and she has sisters who fly through the air. And I got very excited, and I ran around the table, and I said, and so I was, when I sat down, when I was told to sit down, I said, well, can I read about this? And she said, yeah, I can find a book about it. My parents were not opera lovers in our sense. They went, as people really did, we're talking 1944 now, as people did around this time, a lot of times people went to the opera as a social thing, as it was an appropriate thing to do. They liked it, and they had both been in school in New York, and they had heard, my father had heard Caruso, my mother hadn't, but they'd heard other people, you know, sing at the Met, and it was a very casual thing. So anyway, she brought the book, and she opened this book of Helen Dyke's Stories of the Metropolitan Opera, which I still have. And she opened it to De Valcura and gave it to me, and I read it, and then I read the whole ring, and then I read the whole book. And I was fascinated. And then that was that. And a month later or so, maybe a week, I don't know how long later, I told my teacher I'd been doing this, and she said, well, you ought to listen to opera. And I said, well, how do you do that? And she said, well, the Met has broadcasts. And she told me about the broadcast. And I started listening, and I was amazed. I loved it. And I think that it was the next fall when I first, and I was fascinated in the Wagner stories particularly, and it was the next fall when there was a Valkyrie broadcast, and that just excited me to death. Now, I mean, it doesn't make any sense, I know, this young, being all that interested in it, but that is exactly what it was. And I finally, my parents finally, this was World War II, but that next December, there was a small opera company, not really so small, called Fortune Gallo's San Carlo Opera. And they toured America. I think the years on the San Carlo were 1928, maybe the late 20s, up until, I just heard the other day they extended up until 1950. But at any rate, they were traveling around even during the war, which has always been fascinating to me how they could do it. But they came to Dallas, they came to Seattle also, I've discovered in looking at the papers here. And in those days they would bring, I think, 10 days of performances or 2 weeks of performances. They'd bring five operas. I'm sure they were all soft sets, rolled up sets, you know, which they could do. They had a company that went with them. And I know that first year, one of the operas was Lohengrin, which I wanted to see, but my parents thought I was much too young to go to a Wagner opera, and we went to Aida and Faust. And the next year they came back. By that time I was listening to the broadcast all the time. They did Carmen and Trovatore. And then that was 45. And then they stopped coming because the Met went back on tour. And the Metropolitan Opera came to Dallas. So that spring of the spring of 46, I went to the Met. And then from then on I went to the Met every time they came to Dallas and all the performances. And I was just hooked. I mean, I you know, you can't, I can't by any explain in any way why I was so tuned on to opera so young, but I was, that was the way it was.
And you were born in Dallas, correct?
Yes, yes.
So that's when everything started. And also explain, that was my next question, your bug for Wagner.
And that's how it was. It started right at the beginning.
That was basically the first things that you started listening to.
And it was strange because I was, of course, I love Verdi, and but I remember, Eduardo, it was very strange. When the Met came that first time, the first opera was Die Rosenkavalier, which was a little much for me to grasp at that point in my life. But the next afternoon was Rigoletto. And I came home after Rigoletto, and I was sitting outside to water the flowers because it was hot. I know that was the only time the Met ever came late in May to Texas, because there was no air conditioning in the theaters and it was really hot. But I was out there watering it, and I said to myself, and I can remember this moment, this is my life. This is what I'm going to do. And I never really changed from that. I mean, even though I didn't want to sing, and I didn't want to conduct, and I didn't want to direct, what I wanted to do is what I do. But I certainly didn't presume to think I could do that. And it was a very confusing thing to my parents. That's one of the things that went on. I happened to have a legal degree, and my parents pushed me to, you know, what do you want to do? Sit in a theater your whole life, just looking at opera? I mean, I was very hard to pin down what I wanted. But I, you know, this is what I wanted to do. And I mean, I know now, I didn't know then.
It's very interesting, I must say, as the point of a singer that have been working with you for several years now, to see an artistic administrator, director, come into the rehearsals as often as you do. And that is my next question.
Why do I do that?
I know that it's because of love. That will be my thought.
It's because I didn't know what I was supposed to do. As you know, I don't want to dwell on my biography, as it were, but when I got out of the Army, and I was in the Army for 4.5 years, and I was a lawyer, I didn't want to practice law. And as I said, I didn't know what I wanted to do in opera, but I knew I could write. And I came to New York. I didn't really know anybody in New York. I mean, I had my friends from school, but I didn't have any real connections. And so I started writing, and I started being published. And so, as you know, for 17 years, I was a writer, a critic, a speaker, and radio and television and all that stuff in New York before I came out here. Well, when I was asked by the board to come and be general director of this company, the only thing I really knew was opera. I didn't know, and I'd done a little bit of fundraising for the Met. I knew a little bit about fundraising. But I didn't know the practical side of things, really. I didn't know really how backstage worked at all. And I certainly didn't know what general directors were, quote-unquote, supposed to do. So when I came in and took over, and the way Seattle did it, my predecessor left before I got here, so I didn't hear anything from him. And we started the first performance. The first was to be The Marriage of Figaro in that September. As general director, it seemed logical to me to go to the rehearsal, because I wanted to see what was happening, and I wanted to learn what was happening backstage. And the one thing I did know was that I would be responsible for whatever was on the stage as long as I was general director of this company. And although there are general directors, a lot of general directors who have a completely different idea, who believe that you hire a director and that he chooses the set designer and the lighting designer, and it's his job, and you either, you know, you can say a few things about it, but basically it is he who makes the decisions. And I would be responsible to the public for what went on the stage, because I felt that's what I was hired for. And as I say, there are directors general directors who believe that you hire somebody and it's their responsibility, and if it's not something the general director wants, then he or she can complain about it. I've never done that. I believe I should be a part of it, and I should that anything that goes on the stage of Seattle Opera is my responsibility. This isn't quite what it means. It doesn't mean that every single thing that's ever gone on the stage is what I want. It does mean that if I see something that I don't like, I will, after a rehearsal, talk to a director about it. if he or she can convince me that there's a reason for it, then it's fine. Then I'll end it up there. So everything's not the way I want it to be. But I'm going to be in a position where I can defend every single thing we do. And that's what I've done. So basically, the reason I go to rehearsals is because I wanted to do it and because I didn't realize that most people didn't. And so when I did it the first time, and then I did it the second time, and I liked it, and I liked the result, then I just kept on doing it. And it was a full year or a year and a half before I even knew that what I was doing was unusual.
You know, for the first...
There's one other thing.
For the first 10, 15 years, you educated yourself, and you were into the visit, but now, I mean... You have even a chair in the rehearsal place with your name.
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure that has to do with that too, and you want to see what is going on. But I'm sure that it's also because you love to be involved in the process.
I think it's my job to be involved in the process, and I love doing it. Yeah, I mean, you know, some operas you love more than you do others, but I'm pretty eclectic in what I like, and I just believe that this is what I should do.
Excellent.
And I think one thing I do want to say about it, there's one benefit to doing this that I didn't even realize for maybe 5 or 6 years. I remember when I did first realize it was like 4 years into it when we were working with a particular cast of people. I would say that 90% of the singers are very dedicated and want to work hard all the time, but sometimes when you get really starry people, they can be deconcentrating, as it were, in a rehearsal. This doesn't happen here because I'm there and I write the checks.
Yes,
and that
especially
is,
people like me. You mean
that's something? Yeah, that's something that I discovered at that point when I was working with a very famous singer who everybody was amazed because he was so concentrated on it, you know, and I realized suddenly that was a good idea for me to be there.
It's a fantastic reason. I have a couple of more kind of personal questions. You've been involved with the operas, not only in Seattle but all over the country, doing auditions, listening to live performances. What you will say that from the old generations of singers, that we didn't have an opportunity, or my students didn't have an opportunity to listen to it, for you were very remarkable, or still remarkable if you think that somebody is today, from the people that you started listening to it from the 40s until to now. Just name a couple of them that for you left an incredible impression about singing and acting on the stage.
Well, a lot of people have done that over the years. Really, it isn't just one or two. There's a whole lot of people have done that. I think in the first few years, in the 40s, acting-wise, I think there wasn't the kind of acting we have now. It just didn't happen. But I think that somebody like H.O. Pinza, who was a famous bass and who went on to do musicals in New York, I mean, I remember his Boris, and I remember his doing several things. He was quite a formidable figure on stage. And there were a few others. But I think that because I basically am a vocal person more than anything else, even though I've worked hard, I said from the very beginning we would have theatrical opera in Seattle. I think that's 49% of it. But I'm basically vocal. It's the people who really impressed me with not only vocalism but theatrical vocalism. That is to say, what I believe in opera, I think that singing beautifully is nice, but unless you are the most extraordinarily beautiful singing person in the world, such as Joan Sutherland, that doesn't get you, you know, that and 50 cents don't get you to Brooklyn. It's not, in other words, it's not, that doesn't matter. Beautiful singing by itself is not very interesting to me. What is interesting to me are singers who can convey feeling and can convey the words and pay attention to the words. And so, therefore, the people who have influenced me the most as singers were first Maria Callas, who I had the opportunity to hear more than a few times, and then moving later than Kallas, Birgit Nielsen, Leonie Riesenick, Renata Scotto. I'm naming women because I just am, because women oftentimes do have the capacity to color a little more. Certainly on the male side, Jussi Björling was a tremendous voice. That's exactly what it wasn't. It wasn't a large voice, but it was a tremendous technique and beautiful sound that you had. You know, and then, of course, Franco Corelli was somebody who was a force of nature. And I've never seen anyone like Corelli beforehand. Well, actually, that's not true. The first person kind of like Corelli was Mario Del Monaco, who was, in my time, who was marvelous. But Corelli was a little more, Corelli had more capacity for subtlety than Del Monaco did. And Corelli was such an incredibly sexual person on stage. I think that these were the days before I was working as general director, working with singers. But I know the most amazing thing, one of the real shocks, I can still remember it, because I was doing a lot of interviews when I worked at Opera News. This is in the early 60s, but you don't interview everybody. In the early 60s, the late 60s. And I was walking down Broadway near where the Opera News offices were then, and this very average Italian, very average-looking, clearly Italian man walked by me in Prince's Place, said to me, that was Corelli. And I was astounded, because Corelli on stage was one of the most astonishing people you ever saw. I mean, movie star plus, you know, take Clark Gable, and I mean, well, that's 100 years old, but take, that's really a long time back. I'm trying to think of
Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt.
Well, but yeah, take Brad Pitt, that's right. You take Brad Pitt and you add to it a sword fighting, you know, I mean, he was incredible to look at. And here he was on the street, just a perfectly average person that nobody paid any attention to at all. I'll never forget that. That was a strange experience. But I think there were others, too, that have been tremendously important to me in my judgment of how one can sing. Frederica Van Stada is an amazing person, amazing singer, creating her roles, astonishingly. Victoria de los Angeles. Now, one thing we didn't talk about, just in my own personal background, was that you mentioned it was unusual, and it is unusual for me to start out with Wagner. Wagner and Verdi, Puccini, of course. Verdi and Puccini, if you like singing, you're going to like those two. But I didn't get Mozart. Mozart, to me, was kind of pretty, but inconsequential. And I was 17, and I went to a performance of the Met in Dallas with The Marriage of Figaro, and De Los Angeles was the Countess, and suddenly, just like a flash of lightning, I got Mozart, bang. And I mean, I know it was she who did it when she did Porgy e Amore and Dove Sono and everything else you do. I understood, and I've always loved Mozart ever since. But I think that does happen sometimes to people. Sometimes you just don't get it, and then you suddenly do. You know. But there were, but as I say, there were so many. But and of course, I mentioned Leonie Riesenick, who was the most profoundly, I think, the most profoundly outgoing artist I ever really saw on the stage, who sometimes didn't, who didn't ever seem, who just seemed to be living everything she did. And there are those who could say it was too strong, too much, but it never seemed that way to me. And of course, Nielsen was, to anybody who loved Wagner and my age, you have to love Nielsen, because she brought the repertory back. I mean, it had never been long gone, but there was nobody really doing it. But there are worlds of other people that have been significant. Carol Vaness, who I presented here many times in Seattle. I saw Carol when she first started, almost as soon as she came to New York, I saw her. And I thought then, and I think now, she was an enormously versatile artist who did so many things so well and so wonderfully. So there are a whole lot. But all of these people kind of, when you've lived in opera your whole life, as I have, and after all, my life, you know, I was six when I started, that's 68 years of going to opera. And that's a lot of opera to the scene.
That's part of the reason. The reason I ask you this is because I know and the people know in this country and in the world that you take good risks. And by good risks, I mean you brought people to Seattle Opera that nobody knew, mm-hmm. and suddenly they became superstars. Not only because they were in Seattle Opera, but I'm talking even by the fantastic young artist program that you have here. You take people like Lawrence Browley that now is a superstar all over the world. You have this vision, and not only the vision of matching people together that work very well. This is my fourth experience here at Seattle Opera, and I never had problems with my colleagues, which is very unusual in the opera world. And it's because you don't only judge the voices and the staging, but you also judge the characters and how they are going to be matching. But you have this speciality of listening to people and taking risks. People that nobody know from Europe, you bring them here, they suddenly do a fantastic show. And here is coming some of my students' questions regarding this. When you do these auditions for young people, I mean, you go all over the planet, but also fundamentally in New York or in Seattle.
And then Europe, too.
And they come, you hear 150, 200 mm-hmm. singers in 2 days.
Not that many, but you do 80. I do about 80 singers in 3 days.
Yes, in 3 days, mm-hmm. which is a lot.
It is
a lot. You specifically talk about how they put the drama in the voice, not only the beautiful, but what else do you think singers need to be aware, especially in this century? I mean, we have now 11 years of the 21st century in the era of communication. Opera obviously is changing, DVDs, live broadcast from the Met, things that didn't exist 40 years ago. So what you are looking in the young artists now?
Well, I think the first question is, I'm looking in young artists exactly the way I have looked ever since I started auditioning, and that is the first statement is unfortunately frustrating, because I cannot answer what it is when I hear somebody who I know is good and who isn't. I there's no way I can explain this. I can tell you a lot of things not to do. I can tell you some things to do. I can't tell you why when I hear somebody I know they're going to be good. I have no idea. I mean, I really don't know. I wish I could put that into words. I think that for young singers, for young artists today, I think the most important thing in the world to do is, first of all, there are several important things. One is language. Anybody who wants to sing opera should not only get a passing knowledge of German, French, and Italian, but should, I'm talking about Americans now, after they become an adult, start their career, they should go to one of those countries and spend a few months. I had a very brilliant soprano here a little over a year ago, and I think she's going to be a great Verdi soprano. And I told her, and she's a very, very smart young woman, and I said, what are you going to do the next 6 months? Because she's just starting out. And I had asked her to come and sing a major role here, which was the first time she had done this. And she said, well, I don't know. I have some time off. And I said, okay, go to Italy. Go to Italy right now. And I don't care whether you study voice there or not. It's good to get coaching. But live in Italy and speak the language. Learn the language. Learn how to speak it. One of the great troubles in America is that American singers are smart and they can learn to speak, to sing French, German, Italian, or Czech. Well, Czech is a little different, because Czech, I'm not asking anybody to learn Czechoslovakian, but the three big singing languages, they can learn them syllabically. They can pronounce them well, but they're never going to be great until they get over there and be able to handle themselves on a street in Rome, or a street in Paris, or a street in Berlin. Because you cannot, I mean, it's just as when I'm saying to you, let's go to town. If I say to you, you know, as an American, let's go to town. That's one way to say it. Let's go to town. Let's go to town. You know, I mean, we know our language is like any other. You articulate certain things. You emphasize certain things without thinking, because our minds do that. Unless you can speak one of those, unless you can speak the language you're singing, you can't possibly do that. You don't know. Yes, you can follow the composer's markings, but you're not going to be as good. So language, to me, is one thing that is absolutely essential. And now, the other thing is that no singer should be content just working with a voice teacher. They need to take drama. They need to know. I mean, there was a day, oh, I suppose it was 10 or 12 years ago. No, it was longer than that. It was probably 15 years ago when we had somebody out here, and I think it was in a ring, where when we were doing a ring, where the person was confused with the director when he said, "Go upstage," and the composer and the singer looked at him kind of confused. I mean, that was obviously not a person who was going to go very far. But you need drama lessons too, because, and also, and this is fair, I think, to say, and it's not, I don't apologize for this at all. I don't care what, I mean, I think that when I read in the paper that there were people who were complaining about Michelle Obama's campaign against obesity, because they claim this is the government getting, I mean, it just makes me so mad, I'd like to kill, because obviously we have a huge problem with weight in this country. We didn't, when I was young, we laughed at the Germans as being fat. The Germans are svelte compared to us now. And of course, I think we know why, fast food, all that stuff, you know, all those things have done it. But the point is, what was acceptable in the 80s and the 90s with people being vastly overweight is not acceptable now, and it's going to be even less acceptable as we move along. So singers had just better get themselves on their horses and realize that when they're young, when they can do it, and until you're 40, it's not hard to take weight off. It's never easy to take weight off, but it's a heck of a lot harder after you're 40 than before you're 40.
Yeah, it's true.
And they just better get used to it, taking the weight off. And don't tell me that you have to sing Wagner and be fat.
No.
That's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, there's no way in the world. There are a lot of people who've sung Wagner who are very slim. Greer Grimsley is the greatest photon I know, and Greer is thinner than I am.
Yes. Very in shape.
And he's in good shape. So I would say for singers outside of the obviously learning technique, you have to learn language. You have to keep, and you said the shape, which is right. You have to exercise to keep yourself in shape and not get heavy. Those are things that are really important. And you've got to study. You've got to take some theater courses. You've got to learn the basics of drama, because it's very important. Now, what is crucial with us, which is what a coach can help you, but which is inherent in the person's capacity to do, is to take the learning in drama and all this other stuff and put it in the voice. Because, I mean, you have to project the personality of the singer, of the character, through the voice. Not in opera, so many times it's not through actions, which it is often on the stage, in legitimate theater. It's through the voice. You have to color, you have to shape, you have to phrase. And just singing flat, flat's the wrong word to use, but just singing as singing.
Yeah, like in a robotic
way. In a robotic way, it's not interesting.
No.
It's just not interesting. And also, the one other thing I would say, American audiences, now I think this is true, that in America, people do like a lot of voice. They like loud. They like loud, as it were. But all I can say is I'm here as one person who never hires anybody who yells at me. I mean, singing opera is not singing loud. It is coloring, it is shaping, it is dynamic. It's dynamic. The whole business of singing in opera is to use dynamics and to use them if you have something that's important. If you're going to sing The Curse from Tristan, Isolde is obviously going to be loud because the orchestra is thundering and you're saying death to the traitor, death, vengeance, and so on, death, so on and so forth. You're going to be loud. Ortrud is going to be loud when she does her curse. But so many things, when you're singing Kegelita Menina, which is Rodolfo's aria in the first act of Bohème, and this is an entree into a larger point. But I'm glad I got onto that. If you say Kejalita, if you're singing Kejalita Manina, and you look at me, and you sing this presentationally, as though you were singing, we'll say, Celeste Aida, then I know you don't have the least idea what Bohem is about, because he's trying to win this girl. He's just telling her about himself. He's telling her he's a poet. He's telling her he doesn't have any money. He's telling her he loves her. He's saying, but he's talking to her. And Puccini expects you to do that. So if you stand up and you sing this with great bravado, as though you're an Egyptian general getting ready to go to war, you just don't understand it. And the same thing for Mimi's Mi Chiamo No Mimi. She's scared. She may not be scared. There are interpretations where she actually wanted to come in the room. But under any condition, she wants to be, she wants to win him. And so she sings Mi Chiamo No Mimi that way. And you have to do that. You have to think about it. Or if you do the Addio from Bohème and you sing it as some grand statement, you don't know anything about the opera.
Yeah.
And I mean, there have been many singers, not many, but there have been frequently in auditions, not frequently either, it's not true, but there have been times in audition when I get somebody who apparently has a good voice and is singing, and I usually let them get through it, and then I say to them, what was that about? You know, and it's astonishing sometimes. If you have to ask the question, you can almost be sure they can't tell you. They can sort of say, oh, well, this girl is, you know, they can do a little, but they can't really tell you what it's about.
Have you ever took the risk of somebody that you thought they had the magic, but they didn't have the connection, and you thought, if I give him a contract or her a contract, I can coach them?
Mm-mm.
You never took that.
We don't have time for that.
You don't have time for that.
We don't have time. I mean, I'd love to do that. We certainly do that with young artists all the time,
yeah.
With the young artist program. But I mean, when you're hiring for the main stage, I can't do it because I have 3 weeks of rehearsal before we go into the theater. So you know, there's no way. You can see people who are heartbreaking because you see that they've got the goods, and then all you can say to them or to their agents is, get this person to a coach, get them to learn what this is about. I mean, I think one of the most horrifying things I ever heard was that there was two people who were married, and I don't know whether this was true or not, but there was a married couple who maybe 10 years ago were quite famous, and they were doing, they were going to do a Bohème at the Met, and they went through a regular coaching, going through a coaching process, and they told the coach, oh, we're not interested in the tradition, we just do it our way. Well, the point is, American voice teachers have a horrible habit, in my opinion, of telling young singers, oh, don't listen to people, don't listen to recordings of people because you don't want to sing like them. I think this is beyond stupid.
Enough.
Of course you don't want to sing like anybody. Worlds of sopranos have killed themselves because they've tried to sound like Maria Callas, and it's ridiculous. But how on earth are young singers going to learn the 400 years tradition of this business, or we'll just say the 150 years tradition of most of the operas we're dealing with, without hearing what great people have done with it? And it's why I always say, when I talk to classes, are you listening to the Met broadcasts? 90% of the time, the singers just look at me, even if they don't know that the Met broadcast exists or they never listen to them. Why not? It's not because these are so great. It's not because they're always good. You're going to find out bad things and good things, but you're going to hear the way people do this at the leading house in America, and that they've been extremely well coached. So you can hear how people negotiate certain difficult passages. And that way you listen, and you're not trying to sound like this person, but you understand what they've done. And it's just, it's profoundly simple. But
yes, I my students has part of the curriculum that I do, they have to listen to people from week to week, and they need to tell me what they listen to it and to whom. And especially today that they have access with YouTube, for example,
exactly.
That they can not only listen, they can see them.
Everybody's there. Yeah.
I mean, they can see the performance. They can see that the physicality of the performance. There are even master classes online of Pavarotti talking about support and talking about appoggio, which is very, very important. And we like that. We it's not only the tradition. I think the tradition also sometimes is started by mistakes or by things that people needed to do. But you know, if they needed to do it, and for 30 years they are doing it, maybe we need to listen to these 30 or 40 years of tradition, or 150, why they did it one way. But which brings me to the next question. During the last, I would say, 30 years, 40 years, it has been a change on the fachs of people. It used to be soprano, lyric, soprano spinto, soprano leggera, coloratura, plus. Now there is 16 categories for a bass, 25 for a tenor. And it used to be that a soprano, like Maria Callas that you named before, will take roles from different type of these fach categories. Today is more specialized. So when you go to an audition, you are looking for that specialization as well, meaning this role for this person, and you think also the possibility that this person can take different roles in their career.
Oh, I don't buy this speciality. I don't buy the whole idea of highly specializing fachs. I think that's just wrong. I think that, yeah, it's true that Lili Lehmann at the beginning of the 20th century was a famous Wagner soprano who also sang Carmen. I think that kind of stretches our imagination a good bit. But I think that you need to explore a lot of different parts and see where you can go. You know, Krista Ludwig is a classic example of somebody who did a whole variety of things, and she decided that she could be a soprano. She took two or three soprano roles. She was great in them, but she wasn't comfortable, so she dropped back to being a mezzo. I think you have to try out things. You know, a lyric tenor shouldn't try to sing Otello, but you have to push a little bit to see. Now, I think a tenor like, you mentioned Larry Brownlee earlier. Larry is so smart about what he's doing, because Larry is the classic bel canto tenor who not only has a workable D flat, but has a workable F, which he's saying here. Now, when you have a voice like that, you're going to stick in bel canto, if you have any sense, and you're not going to go into Verdi, you're not going to mess it up. Now, I don't think that those really high notes are going to stay with Larry forever, because they never do stay with anybody. Maybe they will with him. But when his voice comes down a little bit, then he sings high. You know, you just have to watch comfortably, but you don't ever take your voice down. Or I suppose a bass take it up, but you don't ever worry with the high notes you've got. You want to make sure you're there. In fact, I've heard it said many times. I've heard it said several times by people that know that when you work with a teacher, and there is no teacher right for everyone. The teacher is the relationship between singer and teacher is not unlike the relation between therapist and patient. You know, it's a very personal thing. But I do think this is true, that if you go to a teacher and you think the teacher and you like the teacher, but after 6 months, not 3 months, but 6 months, you're having more trouble with high notes than when you went to start off with, then it's not working.
Yeah, you need to change.
You need to change, you know. But you got to give them 6 months and then you see. I mean, it's, these things are all practical, how you work it out. But the narrowing of Fox, I just don't get. I don't see why that is, because I think you should explore different things and move in different areas, as long as you just don't go crazy. I mean, there, you know, you, if you're a Wagner tenor, if you are a tenor who sings heroic repertory, or if you are a soprano or tenor who seems to have a pretty big voice, then you have to be careful, because they will push. Like I have, there's a young Italian tenor who I think is marvelous, and I think that there will be a time when he can sing Cavaradossi, when he can sing Pinkerton, when he may even be able to sing, if anybody does, Gioconda, Enzo, or maybe Don Carlo. But at this point, he is being very careful singing Ernesto and Don Pasquale, The Elixir of Love with Nemorino, and singing Rigoletto, Bohème, but nothing heavier than Bohème, because he's barely 30. And you've got to stay there for a while, and then you can eventually carefully add. But if you start jumping into Cavaradossi, or worse, or Don José, or worse, Balo, Renato, Ricardo.
Ricardo.
It's not good.
No.
It's not good, because then you're going to shoot your voice.
Yeah. Let me pass. How are we doing with time, Spade? We are doing okay? Mm-hmm. You tell me mm-hmm. it's enough. Okay. What do you think about, what is your thought about competitions? Is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea? Are they good competitions that you would recommend? Like, you know, the Met auditions is a very interesting one.
Do you think what one?
The Metropolitan, yeah. and the, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. the National. Do you think it's good for a young singer to go into competitions, or is it a different profession?
Or I don't have much feeling about them. I think it's okay. I mean, I think the Met auditions are good. I think, from what I've understood, the Pavarotti's auditions and Domingo's auditions are all good. I don't have much. The George London auditions, I've heard those. I mean, I think it's okay. I think it's one way. I think there are audition winners who are not who are not winners in real life. I think that's a pity, because judges do choose some people, you know, who are not going to win the next. I think it's okay to do them. I mean, I think it's kind of a way you test yourself against your own age group, and I don't see any harm in
doing it. But basically, it's not a guarantee that winning in a competition will give you a career.
No,
it's never. Like I always also give the example. It's very interesting when you listen at the famous masterclass of Maria Callas you did in Juilliard, that then they put it in a play in Broadway. That no one of those singers that they were in that masterclass basically made it.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't even mean that if you go to a great institution and you get a diploma for a fantastic institution that you will make it. It needs to be certain magic in the work you do, and there are no guarantees. But basically, you need to keep trying until you know.
That's right. I mean, you know, the people that have studied with voice teachers or done competitions. I mean, Nilsson never did a competition in her life, so far as I know, and she was taught by her mother, who was the famous story of Nilsson coming home. To her mother after she'd been singing for a few years, and told her mother that she was having trouble with her high C, and her mother said, "Why?" And she said, "Well, I just can't seem to get it." And she said, "Well, come outside." And she went outside and said, "This is the way you do it." And she sang it perfectly, and Nilsson, when she was out with the cows, and Nilsson figured it out what she was doing and did it. I mean,
you just go on and do it.
It's ridiculous. What's wrong with your high C? Just sing it.
So the last three questions. Have you ever been in a situation as a general director that you thought of somebody to bring at Seattle Opera, and then this person, for X or Y reason, weren't performing as well as you thought that in the audition will do, and you needed to take a hard decision to let them go? Have that situation ever came to you at the company?
Oh, yeah.
We don't need to name names.
I think maybe, I have lost count, but I think maybe over almost 28 years, I think maybe 8 times. And it was always for different reasons. Sometimes, in one case, I simply overparted a person. It was ridiculous. I mean, I wasn't that much younger. But I just asked somebody to do something who, the role was just a bad idea. There are other times when I've found that somebody was just simply theatrically completely wrong for the part, that needed a lot of theater, that just simply just wouldn't work. I can remember another time when everything about the person was good except for one or two notes, but those one or two notes were the one or two notes that people paid the most attention to in the whole score. You know,
were people ever came unprepared for operas, like they didn't know the score, no memorized?
Well, this is a terrible. Yeah, I'm glad to talk to students about this, because I would say that in the first 20 years I was here, or the first 18 years of my intendancy here, you would run into this occasionally with some Europeans. Not often. You never ran into it with Americans. Sad to say, in the last 10 years, more and more Americans are coming unprepared. And not completely unprepared, but not as prepared as they used to be. And Americans were always prepared before. And I don't know why this is. I don't know why people have gotten sloppy. I know that one reason is because they sing too much and they hurry between from place to place. But that's not completely it. They've come in without knowing what it is. I mean, I know... It's very concerning. It's terribly concerning. I've never fired anybody here who didn't know it. One reason is because the rules of the American Guild of Musical Artists make it so tough to do that. Theoretically, you can fire somebody if they don't know the material, but then as long as they're learning it, it gets very tricky. I have had that where we've had to pound the words and music into somebody's head, and that's just horrible because they're never going to act. They may end up singing and singing well, but they're never going to do the action because they can't possibly think about it. They've got to think about the words all the time. And I find this so depressing that it happens with that it's happening with Americans now. Shocking with Americans.
That's sad. That's very sad. Now, I have a grad student that asks you this. What is the most proud of the thing that you're more proud about Seattle Opera in all these years that you've been working with? I mean, I need to say you did not only fantastic productions, you have the Wagner Festival.
You
rebuild the theater into a magnificent, incredible theater. I must say this for people that have never been here. There is no one seat that you cannot see the stage or hear the stage. The dressing rooms have the details of having incredible wide doors. And I said, why? Everybody's fat. He says, no, it's for the costumes. So people
that's
will,
true.
But
I
yeah,
didn't
you told me that.
Yeah, but you know, but that's not me. That's not me. That's Jane Eaglin. Jane Eaglin, who was here then at the time, said, make those doors wide because 18th century costumes cannot go through narrow doors.
But that's you, because you took that in consideration
and I told him,
and you made it.
I said, yes, that's good.
I remember when you did the tour for us when the theater was in construction that I ran into the stage and shouted, ah, now will be the first singer I sang in the theater. And he said, no, wrong, they did it before you. But I remember that you told details about, you know, putting the dryers in the bathrooms lower so the water would not run into the suits or the costumes of the lady. I mean, all these details. So what it makes you proud about? What is your personal achievement in Seattle Opera? And I'm sure it's not the budget, or it's not. It's, I
oh,
mean,
no.
plus in an era,
God, no.
plus in an era where for our sorrow, you know, we have all these opera companies closing and bankruptcy and things like that. But what really makes you proud that you said, okay, this is my legacy?
Well, I can't say that. I can't say. I would never say this is my legacy. I thought you were going to ask. What is the one thing that I, yeah? Well, our legacy.
Yeah. Oh, what is the one thing
that
you're
proud of?
Proud
I suppose
of.
It's you know it's funny. That's a question that I've never been asked, oddly enough, that I can remember. But I think I think in a question like this, it's like with exams, like in examinations, you better answer what comes first to your mind, and not try to think about it. You'll think about a lot of things.
All of the above. Yes.
All of the above. But I think it's probably what makes me the happiest is that. Well, let me explain it by telling a story. When I came to Seattle Opera, I told the people here that what I wanted most was summed up by Birgit Nilsson in a newspaper article that she in an interview for the New York Times. She was having trouble with the Metropolitan, and she was angry at one of Rudolph Bing, who was the general manager, one of his assistants, because of something that was done. I don't know and have any idea what it was. And she was very angry, and she said that she might not come back the next year, which did not happen. But she said, songbirds sing when they're happy. And when I came here, I told the people who worked for me that this was what I intended to have as the rule at Seattle Opera, that there are different personalities as singers. There are people that are easy, there are people that are difficult. But that our job was to make people feel good when they're here, because that's the way we can get good performances for the audience. Now, as I said, if a person comes in and is unpleasant, particularly to the people with whom they're working, such as dressers or wigs people or stagehands, if they're unpleasant, I probably won't bring them back, because I'll know, and people will tell me. But that while they're here, they must be treated with kid gloves. They must be treated wonderfully, and because that's the way we can get the best performances. And I've used that story many times, and everybody who works here knows that story. Everybody knows that. And you'd be amazed at the number of people that have come through this company who are classically difficult, who have been easy as pie here. have never given any trouble. Now, so I think maybe the thing that I'm the proudest of is that we have been able to do that over these years and have been able to make people not only feel good when they're here, but want to come back. And, you know, that we've had, and that by doing this, by working, and I think along with that comes the collaboration of my whole staff, the fact that everybody here is working to the same goal. And I don't mean that this doesn't happen in other opera companies. It does, I'm sure. But it's just that for me, this has been very important to me, to have everybody working together toward this goal to make people feel good, to make them sure of themselves, and in order to give the best performance, because I think that's what does it. In other words, I am absolutely irreconcilably opposed to the idea that you can be unpleasant with people or that you have to be rough on people for them to do well. I think, on the other hand, you have to be nice to people, and if you're nice to them and if they like you and they want to do something, then they'll be better.
And with that note, I must say that it's true. As a singer, Seattle Opera is one of the places that I have been treated the best. And I told you that.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
I told you that before, because it is true. I mean, and every singer I know, just don't buy an apartment in Seattle if you're a singer. That's the curse. You buy an apartment, Spade will not bring you back.
That's not true. That's not true.
No, just kidding. But
there are a lot of people with apartments here. Because Seattle's a very easy place to love. And people, the only thing I keep telling when people tell me they're going to buy an apartment, I'm going to say, well, you know, we're kind of far up in the Northwest. It's easy. Yeah, but the airport is, yeah, fine. You know, it does that. But, you know, we're not.
But one last thing. I know that it's difficult to advise somebody that is 18 years old today what to do with their lives. Mm-hmm. But if somebody that is 18 years old and is committed and he loves the world of performance, especially in opera and oratorio and mm-hmm. lead, what will be your 2 cents or dollar advice? What you will give them? Said, okay, do this, do that.
Well, we've talked all about this. I've already talked about what they need to study. But the only bit of advice I would give them is, which is kind of doesn't sound maybe very cheerful, or might even sound cynical, and I don't mean it to be cynical, I mean it to be true, that if they can do anything in the world other than sing opera, then do it. If you know that the only thing you can do is to sing, then go on with it. But if there's anything else on earth you're interested in, do it, because this is a very competitive profession with very little room at the top. And as Riesenik always used to say, in her case, it was very easy to get to the top, but staying there, as she did for 43 years, that's the hard thing. But that's what I mean. There has to be a sense that this is the only thing you can do. Then it's okay to do it. Otherwise, go out and do whatever else, because almost everything's easier.
And thank you so much for that advice.
Sure.
And thank you for this time. And
thank you for all your wonderful performances here.
Thank you, Spade.